Good afternoon, good evening, good metal. My name's Cooper and welcome to the Spoken Metal Show. This episode is one of, like, I hope you get a lot from this episode. I hope you get a lot from all of the episodes, but this one in particular, you know, fuck me. Do you ever think that you're not doing enough work? You're not knocking your pan out. This is the episode. It's with the absolutely wonderful Eric Vaughan, and what a journey he's had, and what a kind of, like, you know, think his legacy he's creating at the moment is absolutely incredible. I won't kind of spill too much tea yet. I'll let you get into the episode and hear that. But this is a great one for anybody needing any motivation into doing their projects. And speaking of which, I have my own project, which is going to be on Thursday, the 9th of November, at the wonderful, my home from home, the Outpost, where I'll be doing the Spoken Metal Show live. What the fuck is that? It's this with guests. I'm going to be speaking to Christopher Brown, UK music solicitor, and an open Q&A as well with him, so you can ask a solicitor the questions that we need to know about stuff, about being in a band and not getting ripped off, and these important things. Also, I'll be having those music guys on as well. Wonderful set of guys that have been on their show a few times now. And they've got some wonderful stories individually and collectively as the podcast are doing. And also, we announced very recently that the support, I got support. Isn't that fucking crackers? That, you know, you do these things up and then people are happy and welcome, want to support you. So I've got a support act. This is fucking insane. And that support is the wonderful. And we've had him on the show before. He's Spoken Metal alumni. And we've seen him many times before. We love him to bits. It's the Mad Span doing his unique brand of comedy, you know, and it's wonderful to be able to do that, and wonderful to be able to kind of have someone who you think the world of and you find incredibly funny to be supporting you, you know, before we even get to the main events. I've still got some more surprises to come as well. This is a free event. It's free, ladies and gentlemen, so please register for your tickets. That's going to be on Thursday, the 9th of November at the Outpost, the Spoken Metal Show live. And then we've got other events coming up, but we'll get to them. Did you everybody see that announcement with Conan? Fuck, that's fucking... February just looks like it's going to be absolutely ridiculous, and there's lots more of interesting stuff coming too. We've got Metal on Merseyside doing a symposium as well, like about radio and stuff. More details to follow with that. I'll be just doing a special show about that. And then the day after is going to be Conan playing with a whole heap of great support, Crepitation, Nova Crow, Spitfire. You know, there's some amazing stuff going on, and I hope you're feeling that the scene is emerging and growing. And that's the key thing here. As I go to a lot of the shows, and I went to a fantastic show with Tail Gunner, Raised by Wolves, The Devil's Henchmen. These are all sold out shows. Way before the doors open, these shows sell out. So it's important to see that not only is it moving, it's thriving as well. But, you know, let's get on with what you're here for. And that's to listen to this show where I speak to some wonderful guests. And Eric Vaughan is one of those guests that I want to talk to. Based in New York, a total Renaissance man, director, an author, a producer, and a musician, and he talks wonderfully, candidly about his life. And, you know, it's not been easy. You know, he's had some real tough times, and now he's coming up to be celebrating sort of 30 years of music. He's going to be bringing out all of his back catalogue, producing it and remastering it and what have you, and starting new projects. And it's just a wonderful thing about kind of, you know, no matter when you start, you can reassign your life and relook at things. And as long as you approach it with a great work ethic and wanting to do the best you can go and go and go and go. And he's just, you know, really funny, you know, really funny because he was honest. You know, we talk about everything. We talk about New York City back in the day, you know, and the metal scene going on there, what it's like now, kind of what it's like to produce, you know, all kinds of things. And it's a fascinating individual. We'll get him on again. And this obviously takes part of a Halloween sort of special that we're doing. With a couple of bits and pieces I've stitched together, like Frankenstein's Monster, to do a couple just collectively, because obviously metal and Halloween are synonymous around the same time, the season of the witch, as they say. So please, I can think of no finer guest to have on than, ladies and gentlemen, you know, I hope you really enjoy the show, because I really enjoyed producing this. It was a lot of fun. This is my conversation with Eric Vaughan. Ladies and gentlemen, I can think, particularly of this season of The Witch, no one more perfect to talk to than my next guest. It's Eric Vaughan, of course. How are we doing, sir? Welcome to the
Hello,
show.
Hello, doing good. It's, of course, speaking of the season of The Witch, I live in a town very famous for such things, where the Headless Horseman was created, actually, Washington Irving. So, of course, Halloween festivities, it's like, for the next, actually, for the it starts... earlier in the like early in August, you start to see it come out, and by October, it's full Halloween 20. It's awesome. It's great up here.
Was that by choice, Eric? Did you see that? Have you always lived there, or did you move there?
No,
Because
no. I grew up in New Hampshire, and of course, I got the music bug when I was 17 or so. Well, actually, before I started recording when I was 15, realized very quickly in the 90s that New Hampshire was not it. I mean, the way we have a scene now worldwide, back then New Hampshire had nothing. You didn't have a, you would play to a club to three guys in a coffee shop, and they really just looked at you like, get the fuck out of here, with this metal shit. Because this was at the height of grunge too. When I got into metal, it was grunge time. So that was a, and I liked industrial, so I started more there, because it, I with a drum machine, you didn't sound like shit if you did industrial. But I
Was it
moved
like a,
to,
was it you so you live in like essentially Sleepy Hollow, if you will, and was it a similar thing where, like Reznor records in Manson's old house, so you live in Sleepy Hollow. That must come out in the music, right? It's got to have an
I
effect.
mean, the whole neighborhood is so beautiful and so old that when you're walking around, it's absolutely fantastic. I mean, history bleeds. There's a giant cemetery. I mean, it's all gorgeous. It's a fantastic place to be. And after living in New York City for 25 years, I just couldn't with that anymore. I moved there to make music, and then ironically, with the growth of music and the expansion of the internet, it became almost worse to spend all your money to live in a city when music was happening more on the internet. But that's a whole other story because when I got to New York City, I also found the lifestyle, and I think that crippled me creatively as much as it helped. So when everything started settling down, we had a big tour planned, everything for our 2015 record. Bass player unfortunately passed away. Best friend, I lost my ever living mind. It was too much to deal with. I just quit. I walked away. I was a lunatic. I couldn't get along with anyone anymore. I was just done. It was over. It was time. And then the pandemic happened. And I had long moved on from New York in 2015. It was just not working out, if you will. And when I went around and found a few places, but I'd always loved Sleepy Hollow. So I went back to where I kind of liked the most, as much as it is a huge expense to live here. So basically, during the pandemic, I got married, and my wife, who's a doctor, she was still working, but I was sitting at home going crazy. And she's like, why don't you try the music thing again? So I sat down. Got a recorder. I set up a recording. I'd never had a studio in my life. Always worked with other people. I'm sorry if this is the long way to get to where we're going with this, but
No, you keep going out. No,
it's
you
kind of a tale. And
keep
then it started with one song. I remember I got all the gear, and after much cursing and smashing my head into the wall,
going. No.
because I'm not, I wasn't, I had never used technology in this format. I was a video guy. So I finally, because that's what I did for a living for a long time, was filmmaking. So I finally somehow got this all set up. One song happened, and I was walking around in my headphones going, this is cool. I finished this song that I had the tracks for 10 years ago. And then I sat down, and another one happened, and another one happened, and it hasn't stopped since late 2021 or something. It's just been record after record after record, and I hit. And since I don't have an obligation to play live, it's never stopped. That's where the long and short of this story goes.
No, it's fascinating that that after your friend passes away, that you move away from music. Someone as prolific as yourself, moves away from that. That is a large part of both your friend going and music leaving your life. And it seems like it just built up this thing that when you kind of go, okay, it's time to come back and it's time to start to do this. It just flows out of you because it's always been there, and it's probably something of a coping mechanism as well to
Oh,
deal with,
totally.
an awful thing that's happened, and that's one of the things that the music that when people truly embrace certain genres of music,
find the power in it, that you can do that. You can find solace in extreme music and solace in heavy and dark music. The thing that people level against that form of music is that it's depressive, but it's not. It's a
not even
solace,
remotely
right.
Not even remotely. I grew up really rough. I was orphaned as a child. You know, I was kind of raised by the state, if you will. So that kind of set me off on this trajectory, because unlike a lot of people, you know, mom and dad, and it's teenage rage, I had legitimate things in my life to be angry about. You know, the whole thing just didn't work out. And when I got out of the gate, I was very ill fit for the world. So this was kind of the only thing I had. And I think it's interesting now that I have this recording mechanism, now that I'm a father and I have a regular civil like existence, I can focus on the actual creative end, because the biggest failure I made in the city life is that I got involved in the scene.
Right.
And when you get involved in the scene all the time and you're always at shows, you're always drunk, you're always too tired to put together the records as you want them to be. So you kind of force them out to keep going back to that. And now that that's kind of in the rear view, I can handle the creativity now. And that's the focus, and not on, did I show up at enough shows? Are we drawing enough people?
Was
like
I
the
seat
life.
Enough? Yeah.
Yeah. Was I seat perfect? And it's disgusting.
But a lot of artists that I talk to, you know, they all went into the pandemic in multiple different ways. But the ones that really kind of got the most of it were the ones that, like, you know what, I can't go and do the things that I would normally do. I'm going to shift to this type of thing. And it became almost like their most productive time, because they were distractions away. You know, it was me in the room doing what I wanted to do, unfettered by trends or whatever. And I just produce work. And it sounds like, you know, that's worked out really well for you, rather than being a terrible thing for you. It seems to be a pause for you.
It was the best thing creatively, because finally there was no other noise in my life. And I had a roadmap. I had notebooks from 1994, tapes. And I just started pulling them out one by one, completing them, throwing it on the shelf, pull it out one by one, completing it, putting it on the shelf. It's almost like you very rarely in chance get to rewrite your own history as it should have been done. Most of the time you get to a certain age, you have what you have. And for me, this gave me a chance to actually take the art that I threatened to make and talked about making for decades. And now it's finally coming out in big, big swathes. And I can finally say, I wasn't bullshitting you guys. It's all right here.
Yeah.
And now it's out.
Well, that leads us on quite neatly to the sort of 30th anniversary stuff. You know, I mean, ladies and gentlemen, when I first started to talk to Eric, I was like, I like to completely absorb everybody's back catalogue as best I can. And Eric was like, good luck with that. And I thought, okay, that's a challenge. But there really is. I mean, normally at this point, I would suggest jump off points for people to listen to your music. I wouldn't know where to start. It is that varied. And what's surprisingly amazing about it is the high bar of everything as well. It's normally when someone has a one-man black metal project or whatever it is, the quality tends to dip and wave and whatever. Yours is not the case here. And it jumps from genre pretty quickly and kind of moves up, gets it like completely encompasses it, and then goes on to the next thing. I was overwhelmed, is the only way I could say it. And I listen to a lot of music. I was overwhelmed by the sheer quantity and moreover, the genres that you were covering, synth wave, you know, all kinds of dark industrial and soundtrack stuff. It seemed to be, I mean, was it just a case of you going, okay, this is something I need to complete. Let's pull this off the shelf and let's just go and let's just finish this thing. Was it a case of that, or was there an idea where you were going to go, okay, I feel like going into instrumental music, or I feel like going into this or that? Was there any plan, or was it just, this is what's next?
It's a bit of both, actually. How this all happened is the roadmaps were already there. And it's weird, because revisiting this at 44 versus 15, when that's when the dream started, you pull out tapes, and I had to take old tapes, you know, like actual tapes, put them into the machines. You know, I have a friend who can rip MP3 or whatever, WAV files out of actual analog tapes, DAT tapes, and getting this stuff and then recording over it and making it the 1995 release it should have been and not the shitty tape I handed out to people.
Yeah.
That's where some of it comes from, but this is also representing the entire musical scope of my life. Every one of these at one point was a band that jammed, had other members, and it just never, they were never ambitious enough. Ambition was always my problem, and that created all the good in my life and the bad in my life, if that makes sense, you know, like.
Yeah, 100%.
But now the ambition is to get these records all of these ideas that have been sitting in there forever and on all these, you know, books, notebooks. I mean, I have notebooks where I'm spelling things ridiculously in the 90s, you know, like try to be cool. And you're like, the cringe level of revisiting some of this and fixing some of those lyrics where you're like, oh, my God. But you don't want to fix too much because then you lose the spirit you were in when you wrote the song. That's a very important and difficult part of this is how do you preserve the past while also improving it just enough?
Well, that's like, you know, when ladies and gentlemen, Eric is, you know, an author, a musician, but one of the most impressive things for me personally is also a producer. And what you're talking about, Derek, is producing it properly, you know, not desanitizing it, not taking away what it originally was and creating, you know, being truthful to what the original idea and theme and thematic qualities of what you were doing. And bring it into a more modern setting, just modern recording techniques and modern sounds, you know, not taking it away. You know, all too often someone can produce the shit out of something and take all the life from it and all the meaning all and it. All the depth from it, you know, and that's a real skill. And it's nice that you've had, like, you know, such a long time to kind of let that just gestate, leave it, come back to it and go, you know what, this just needs to be tweaked here. And this just, you can, your eyes have, and ears have matured to the source. You've kind of gone, okay, I know what that kid was saying. I'll help him say that now. You know, you're almost producing yourself. You know, yeah. At 15, at 16, and whatever, you're producing yourself now.
That's a great way to say it, actually. Because yeah. I never thought of it that way, but that is true. Because in a weird way, when I go into the mode of making a certain band or a certain record, the mindset is totally different.
Yeah,
like if I do the Sculpted was new, so we'll get to that later. But something like the Gruesome Gallery re-recordings, all of that stuff was sitting on tapes from, I think, 2005 or whatever. It's when I first really decided I wanted to do some really creaky old school death metal. But those were all on tape. So going back and producing that, I felt like the songs were already there. But to get the sound, I was an outsider to my own. For much of this, I was an outsider to my own work. And yeah, that really, it really felt that way, which is also, I think, how it's been so easy to keep creating so much without exhausting myself. Because it isn't all just like fresh, new me. It's me taking old ideas that I wanted to put out and bringing them back to life, but as almost in two minds.
Yeah, well, I mean, done is the father of more. So the more you completed some of this work and left and were like, okay, that's done. That's actually perfect. I'm sure you went, you know what? I've got impetus to do other stuff now. I'm going to go and record more stuff. And it must have just became this whole self-fulfilling prophecy of just going, okay, I've completed this and I'm going to do some new stuff. And I imagine a lot of the newer material kind of was born from some of that as well. I imagine
you got
some of that from reestablishing the old music, which is a fantastic thing about music when you think about it.
Oh, totally. I mean, this was an explosion for me. And the fact that all of this happened in like 3 years, we have enough material. Most people couldn't do this in a lifetime, this much material. This is, I'm not trying to brag about this. This is a ridiculous amount of nonsense. It's nonsense how much material I created, but how much care went into it. But I also don't, I'm a very impulsive artist in a way. And the soundtrack thing is good that you picked up on that because my number one production influence is not metal, but I love horror soundtracks, orchestras. I think metal suffers when metal is made and produced exclusively by people who listen to metal.
Yeah, I agree. It comes up a lot on the show that we talk to people that before they go on stage, don't listen to metal, even though they're in a metal band. You know, when they're trying to be creative, don't listen to metal. One of the two sort of avenues that a lot of metal artists often go to is soundtracks because of their expansiveness of them and their openness of them. And the, you know, you can, it can be no metal in it at all, but still be extremely heavy. You know, you can still be darkness in that, and it's quite amazing. And then, you know, when you throw in the horror aspect of that, that becomes this wonderful sort of Rubicon of things going on, where it's like, you know, the like horror isn't metal, but it is. And horror took bits from
it
metal,
all is.
And metal took bits from horror, and they also, and it kind of wonderfully comes in. So you can cope, especially with your work, say, you can see that. You can see where every so often this just kind of flows back in. You can see the river coming back in to the mainstream, which is Eric Vaughan. But you can see all these little tributaries that lead to it. And so that makes complete sense to me. You know, there's a lot of metal artists that don't exclusively listen to metal. And I would level to you, say, that those artists that don't just exclusively listen to that are doing the most interesting stuff within that genre.
I think metal suffers a lot from the culture. There is a whole aspect to the culture that has, it's confused itself in many ways. It became a snake that was chasing its own tail. And in some aspects, like with Exodus, it was really fun, you know, like Paul Bailoff talking about stomping out posers. And that's something that happened in a period of time where that was a legitimate argument. You know, in the 80s, you did have this incursions of scenesters, but I think the whole world has changed so much since the inception of what, because everybody sees the 80s as the highlight of metal, and I think that's a very dangerous place to rest, because then you're saying everything has to come from that wellspring. And much with this donor the doom stoner thing, everything is so 70s oriented. But I'm like, but what about Paradise Lost? Of course, one of my all-time favorite bands, you know, but a lot of these doom stoner guys won't give that a chance, even though that is sometimes far more miserable and daunting a listen than this stoner stuff, which is like, I love my space car, you know, like, an electric, and of course, England does it better, because for every American band that's going on about their space car, you have a electric wizard.
Yeah. I mean, it's interesting that you say that the 80s is like sort of, you know, put on a pedestal. And arguably, yes, we did have, you know, some fantastic stuff there. But that's one of the things people forget. People forget as well that, you know, Judas Priest didn't start in the 80s.
Not at all.
They stopped before. If we go back to when you're kind of 15 and 16 and you're discovering that form of music, who are you listening to at that age then? So where does it start for you?
Well, it started because I had my first ever records were Iron Maiden's Killers and Mob Rules. But I had no context at that point in my life to find more metal. So right. I basically went through that year. I got into the Nine Inch Nails thread. Industrial was like the first thing that I had access to that was kind of heavy. So I was really into that. The first two records, the 95 and 96 reissues, focus a lot more on that. And then Metal Maniacs came. This magazine was sitting not a record store, but the grocery store. Mm-hmm. And that magazine, man, they had the demo section and all this. And back in the day, that was the one window in New Hampshire. There was no internet. There was no window except for this magazine. And I would spend all of my money ordering weird records. So I started getting into the really weird stuff, like heavier, but not quite. And then there's another story right after this, but back like from 96 to 97, I found a lot of the good stuff, like, you know, like the rare Maiden records that know, like, cause I had Killers, but couldn't look up a lineup. People don't understand how different a journey metal was when it was very solitary, because you have a lot of the older guys who came up in a metal scene. Or Europeans, where metal still had a foothold. In the 90s in America, it was a corpse. If you were the one dude in town, you were the one dude. And it was like some creepy old guy who worked at the pizzeria who was like, yeah, that's a great shirt. You're like, oh, good. No, thanks, no. So I had that one magazine. So I got into Paradise Lost, you know, because in 96 I bought a Draconian Times, I think
Draconian
it was.
Draconian Times,
That blew my mind, because we did have one record store. If you drove like 5 miles away, there was this one record store that it was huge, Coconuts, and they had everything. So I just started picking out of bins. If it looked cool, you tried it. Back then, there was no roadmap. So sometimes you get something with a really cool packaging cover and it sounded like it was recorded on a Fisher-Price recorder under a bridge, you know, by a troll. But Which is cool sometimes, but back then you had a trial and terror with this. It was all new. And you had nobody else to really talk to about it because nobody cared. You know? I mean, let's be real. Yeah. I bought Judas Priest Jugulator. I remember listening to that on my own. I played it for a chick and she left it. I was like, well, that's the end of that. I was like, my cool factor right there.
That's the benchmark. Like, do you like Jugulator? Is Jack Ripper Owens or do you like Halford? What do you like in it?
Yeah. Halford, of course, though, being my favorite singer of all time. Well, I will always side with him, but Ripper is an undersung talent. I think his whole career, as soon as Priest got into We Need Money mode and sacked him or however it worked. Yeah. I mean, if you see this Ripper, that was met with no disrespect. But when they chose to move on, it was not very graceful to him. And
it's interesting that you bring up, you know, Halford. But, you know, think about like kind of when he, you know, he'd been in Priest all this time with doing nothing else. He was solely doing Priest. There was no side project. He was doing all this. And then in the sort of the 90s, you got Fight. And then you got all these kind of, he went off and did his own thing, Halford, the band itself, you know, and it was probably his most interesting creative period. You know,
I thank you for bringing this up. Oh, no, thank you. I had a huge argument with a lot of my friends when he rejoined Priest. Because if you listen to Crucible is the best record by any man of any lifetime. The lyrics, A Trail of Tears, that ending song, the way he sings that, the lyrics, that is top 10 stuff in any time. Had that had the Priest name, it would be listened to by everybody.
But yeah, stuff off Resurrection is the same as well. It's just, you know, if that had been on a Priest album, that would have been in a Priest set.
What did they give us? What did they give us? A song called Loch Ness. I was terrified. No, when I heard that, I remember sitting in my car going, this is the worst thing in the world. You know, this is so bad. Because my friend, we had a band car, you know, so we're in that car and I put it on and I hear Loch Ness and it's got the opening intro. And my big fear is that they would have a giant Loch Ness dragon, you know, how old Priest, like Halford would come out riding a Loch Ness. And I was like, once again, I have to hide my interest in this from anyone with any kind of like dignity, because this is terrible.
Isn't it crazy when you look back at Judas Priest, the looks that they've had? Yeah, I mean, really all the way back to, like, you know, look after like Sad Wings of Destiny and see the Half with the long hair and a hat on and KK with the hat on and stuff. And none of them looking at all like a metal band. Then you go through to sort of the late 70s with the leather, and then into the 80s and the turbo where they look like something off Star Trek. And then it's like they've had such a...
I love all of it.
You know?
I love all of it. I mean, Turbo is an underrated record. If you get past the ridiculous like single, like Turbo Lover, I still love the song. But what was the one song that was really bad? Wild Nights, Hot and Crazy Days. I don't know why they put that on Metalworks, because that highlighted something that should not have been highlighted.
Metalworks was where they tried to. It wasn't meant to be the best of, was it? I think in the liner notes they talked about it being. Because you have Before the Dawn on there, which is like a proper Judas Priest. And I think it was just to kind of show, look at all the fucking sides of Priest. You know what I mean?
Reckless? Why would you take a perfect track like Reckless and leave that off? And no, we're going to put this shit party song that Motley Crue wouldn't have liked. We're going to put that one on. Yeah, we're thinking. Now, Priest have a long history of being the best metal band that sometimes makes... Here's a good example. I heard the new single Panic Attack, and they were stupid enough to make a lyric video for it. Because at one point it says, I read the words wild neurotic memes. And all I could think is Halford wrote this while, because you know he does his daily Instagram post.
Yes.
With like the greatest boomer tags, love, unity, respect. Like, I don't even know what that has to do with him talking about the new album, but, you know, he's discovered hashtags. God bless him. Still love him. But I'm sitting here reading these lyrics on the screen, and I'm like, oh, no, they've done it again. They've made it because Firepower was perfect.
Agreed. Yeah, agreed.
Tom Alam, having Tom Alam back from
the days of like Priest Live and Defenders and stuff. I had Mark who worked as one of the engineers on Defenders and stuff.
Oh wow.
And that's probably their high benchmark Defenders and Vengeance. I mean, that was when the look, the artwork, and everything came together. You know, for me, that was when it all kind of come together. So when you're listening to these records and you're in an almost a bubble because there's no one else around, when does it start? When do you get to a show? When do you get to see a live show then?
I didn't get to see a live show till I was like 22.
Wow.
There was none of it. You have to understand, like, growing up in New Hampshire, and then I went to college way upstate New York, the first show was a Sabbath at the Toronto Sky Dome in Toronto. Wow. We drove like 10 hours, and Sabbath being my first favorites, that's the first thing I saw, and it blew my mind. But yeah, really, live music was never my main attraction, I'll be honest. Like, I did it for years, and I think it contributed to my failures in certain regards, because the culture of it was very stressful on me. I'm not a people person, and constantly trying to establish professional relationships and hangouts with people was very difficult. And I think it was very counterproductive,
right?
Because I was forcing myself out. So I still only go to shows if it's like Mayhem are still legendarily chaotic. They're amazing. Judas Priest, if they're around. But live music was never really that much of a fixation for me. Records, though, because you could turn off the lights and that's where you lost.
Yeah. So, I mean, because there's a romanticism about when, like, the listeners, you know, maybe not from the States who are listening, don't realize that how, like, when we say New York, you know, there's many facets to that. You can go way up north and the Catskills and stuff, and there's a whole bunch of different areas. Because when you say New York, people must be like, well, hold on, in the 90s and stuff, and wasn't that an absolute hotbed of music, you know, where there were hundreds of venues and stuff, you know, but it's still quite far away from where you were based. Did you go into New York then often to see bands or no?
Not to see them, but we did to play.
Right.
I never in my life, usually, if I really wanted to see a band, I'd somehow finagle us onto that show. Yeah. Because I don't, And I mean, by the end, the culture in New York was very, lots of drugs and drinking, and that was kind of my undoing for a while, is not being good with people, you get into that. And that's how you slick the lines, but then you start getting good with people, then you annoy people, and then everybody's like, ah, fuck this guy. You know, and I really didn't want to be cool and hang out. I wanted to talk about records, and everybody's like, what's fucking wrong with this guy, you know? Because a lot of the metal scene, people forget, people are not as passionate about the genre as some other people. Some people, they grow up in it. Especially in New York, you have a whole bunch of people who grew up in it that they really don't want to sit around and talk about the artwork. And so if you're that guy, you're really fucking annoying to most people. You know, and I really don't. Other than my art, I don't have things. I have martial arts. I have that. But, like, you know, my family life at this point, which we'll talk about, like, the whole spread, how that relationships are a big part if you haven't figured out in a lot of the records. But now having a family and everything, you know, it's like I don't have to wander out to find company.
you've done people now.
No more people.
Because, you know, I mean, I'm thinking, like, you must have played some great venues in New York. You know, you've got, like, you know, stuff in the Bowery and and stuff. And, you know, there's wonderful.
We did LaMore. We did LaMore with the Misfits on Halloween night. And here's a fun story. In high school, I told every motherfucker in high school, I used to carry the Misfits box set around under my arm. I was like, I'm going to open for the Misfits on Halloween night. You believe me, motherfucker. And they're all like, yeah, shut the fuck up. Well, I was standing up on that stage with my guitar in my hand. And it was like, well, fuck all of you. We just got it done.
I love it. That must have been, you must have known that was special to yourself. And it was one of those life moments when that happened. You must have, you know what I mean? When you get the call that you're going to be supporting the Misfits.
I got my way onto that. There was no way that somebody had said something. I made 1,000 phone calls. I annoyed it. Once again, ambition is a way to make a lot of friends and no friends at all. Because you annoy people.
One man's annoyance is another man's driven, isn't it? You know, it's like, look, we're talking about you doing that show because you pissed off someone or you got in someone's face enough to get on that show. But we are talking about it. We're not talking about you not playing that show, you know. So,
well, that's what people don't realize about this business is it. In the end, it is a business as well as an art. And if you want to get things done, you have to figure out how to get to certain places And a lot of times, if you're sitting with other musicians, you're all fighting for a spot. And you're not going to get along. And unfortunately, I was probably too ambitious at times, and I made a lot more enemies than I should have. And, you know, I'm trying to repair a lot of relationships in my sober old age that I probably steamrolled people. And, you know, in my rampage. But I also realized that the live show thing, when I got really sucked into that, you're always thinking, if I open for this one guy, you know, that's tons of people will see us, and that'll be, yeah. And really, that wasn't satisfying at all. It was like chasing a dragon. You keep hoping that somehow, when I should have been at home making records the entire time. I think that's the reality I've learned, is that I'm happier. And if we do tour now, it will be with a proper agent, a proper system. I'm not wasting my time with, you know, smaller.
And that's that's not you being difficult or obstinate. It's you going, look, I know what's required now to get this done the right way. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. That's completely legitimate to do that. You know, and tell me about the Bowery Poetry Club.
Oh, my God. Okay.
What happened there?
So, drummer of KMFDM, John Sover DeSalvo, he was a stage aide. He broke his leg badly doing some stage work. So there was a benefit, and we were called to play the benefit. And essentially what happened is I bled all over the place. We destroyed about $2,000 to $5,000 worth of shit. He didn't get a dollar, and he still thanked us for playing. But that was one of the stupidest nights of my life. But what a good time. That's when it was good.
What a story.
Story. Oh, fuck. I was big in the punk thing at that time, which scene is, I really, after years of metal and being frustrated with metal, I leaned more into the punk stuff.
Yeah, you can hear you can hear that in the music, ladies and gentlemen. There's quite a deep punk thread through a lot of the stuff that especially today. I was deep diving on quite some great punk stuff, like that was real, you know, real old school punk, which I thought was fantastic. When did that sort of come in? Was it because you moved away from metal a little bit? You were like, look, there's some elements of punk and energies of punk that I enjoy.
I kind of felt that metal at that point had become very legitimately tired. Mm. Not that the idea of metal was tired, but metal itself had hit this.
The execution at that time was maybe a little bit tired, and it needed something else. Yeah,
and I just wasn't feeling it at that point. And of course, I was huge into Motorhead and the Damned, and I was like, I just wanted to do something that was more lively. And a lot of these punk things were tapes that never got released or handed out once again to friends, because I didn't think I was a good enough punk musician that was where it's going to jump off. But now that it's come out, it's actually selling a lot more than the other stuff I did. So it's always weird what picks up momentum in a different time, you know, because releasing this much music in a short frame, I have people who contacted me about seven different bands, and there's dudes who like two bands and they can't stand the other six, and it's really weird because it's all you, so you have to take kind of a grace with the fact that some of your shit will not be liked by everybody. But if you're making such diverse shit, you criticism tends to fall off you a bit.
You know, after a while, especially if you believe in yourself like you do, and you believe in the work you're doing, criticism just kind of like falls away, because you've just got too much work to do. You've got too much stuff to get out. You're just like, fuck, I could sit for 2 hours on the internet and kick off on a comment that happens or whatever. But you know what? I'd rather spend 2 hours producing this EP and producing this next song. Yeah. You know, and it's far more useful. It's far more, you know, I'm certain that like, someone like Frank Zappa, who has an enormous body of work, I'm pretty sure he didn't give a fuck what people thought about him, you know. And I love that. I love that of this kind of mass release that you're doing, this mass amount of work. I think it's both incredibly brave, but also incredibly telling of your ability as a musician, sir. Because the bar is very high, as I said before. Like, you know, just when I thought, well, that's pretty good. That's I really like that. The next thing's pretty good as well. And it's like, okay, where's the shift part now? And there isn't any. And so I suppose the question that really kind of it goes to is that when do you feel most at home with, is there a genre that you settle in, or are you happy to be a chameleon of different genres? Is the one that you gravitate to?
I think honestly, the heavier doom metal stuff is where my heart is. But the synth wave lately, that was a recent development. I heard Miami Nights 1984 in, I think, 2016, I think it was. And I fell in love. I was like, this is like metal without the metal. It's very dramatic. It's very epic sounding. And I used to walk around with that in my headphones. And I was like, this is fantastic. Like, why am I? But it took me years to get the technology right to do it. I wasn't going to rush it. That's another thing. If something isn't right, that's why many things will come out even probably 5 years from now. If something isn't right, I don't force it. I put it aside and that's it.
Yeah. Well, that's the other discipline, isn't it, Erica? Is that you've got to, you know, as much as you want to release everything, there has to be quality control. There has to be, you know, there has to be a point where you're like, look, this isn't quite ready yet. This needs a little bit more time. And that's the producer in you, that, because then you go, okay, this is ready. One of the secrets of production is obviously knowing when something needs no more work and it is complete, rather than overcooking it or adding shit that you didn't need to, or adding to it all the bits and pieces. When did the sort of the horror elements and the darker elements seem to always have been there, but there seems to be at certain points more so than others. Was there a time when you really kind of delved into horror imagery and movies and the whole kind of horror genre? Because that seems to be, every so often it seems to raise its head, Night of the Living Dead and things like that. It seems to raise its head. Was there a moment when that became something you massively embraced as well?
Probably before metal. It was because I used to see, and this is another thing, like I look at my son, he's getting into horror at 8, you know, because kids now, you can't hide anything from them. So he came in like, I saw Jason Voorhees in it. And I'm like, how? We weren't allowed to even, but they had the VHS tapes in the stores and you would pick it up and look at the back of the VHS. We couldn't watch the movies, but the imagery stuck with me, you know?
Right.
And of course, growing up a little more dark side than other people, it was a very relatable outlet to see these things. And it was kind of like an externalization of whatever was in my head, but it's always been there. And I try not to lean on it too much because my biggest fear is always to become one of those artists who just tells the TV guide version of a song.
Sure.
If you look at two versions of the Misfits, and I like both, but lyrically, Glenn Danzig was very good at using, in The Misfits, the teen angst aspect of horror movies.
He kind
of used horror movies in a way to explain how teens were kind of like really uncomfortable with the world.
Yeah, Die, 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 My Darling, and things like that had that kind of, I get you,
And even Teenagers from Mars. It's a silly title, but it really is kind of a dark lyric when you delve into it. But when you listen to the Jerry more ruled Misfits, the songs are great, but like the lyrics really sometimes get to a point where it's like, you know, TV guide, like, aha, you know, like it's about, you know, it's not meant to be anything more than entertainment at that point. And sometimes I like to do that for fun, like a couple of songs, but like, if you're not, it's storytelling. And if you're telling somebody else's story too often, you lose what's special in the music because you stop composing riffs that are more personal to you because you're trying to make somebody else, you know, put somebody else's story over. And if it's not coming from you directly, it's such a hard line with the horror. And it also depends because at certain times in my life when I was tromping around New York being an idiot, you didn't have as much of that emptiness of light. It was much more urbane, much more, you know, so much more stimulus. So punk fit into that a bit more, I think.
I mean, I suppose that, you know, someone like Carpenter's going to be massively impressionable on yourself. You know, me and you both are very clearly, you can hear it in your music, you know, most definitely, you know. But I, like for myself, that was my branching point into horror. It was like, well, okay, he's clearly a metal guy and he clearly loves his heavier side of music. Clearly he does, but he's also using synths. What the hell, you know? And so when did you discover Carpenter then?
14. 14. Okay. I saw the first Halloween, still my favorite movie in the genre. Like I can say that The Exorcist is a better movie and that the Shining is a better movie, but Halloween, that atmosphere, is something I've been chasing my whole life, musically, personally, because the whole idea of the shape when he's standing across the street, silently staring, you know, it's it's incredible. And yeah. that the soundtrack, if you know the story behind that, they tested it for theaters without the soundtrack and they hated it. They put the soundtrack in and people were like, holy shit. And that's kind of what I try to do with my music for people listening in their own life. I want it to provide a soundtrack, and I like them having options of what to pick. Many artists say, oh, if you have too many side projects and too many things, you know, you're not truly about it. And I'm like, that's disingenuous because maybe some people are that intellectually or spiritually or whatever, limited to what the one thing they like. And that sounds very, you know, derisive, but I don't mean it that way. Some people, like, they have the one thing that drives them, and that's their passion, and that's it. The more you get out into the world and travel and see things and experience things, like, you know, when my mother died, you have a set of emotions that are all out. You can't let a genre decide how you express your emotions. And I think a lot of people get trapped in that, where they don't want to express certain things because their audience might consider it.
Well, you know, Carpenter's a wonderful explanation of exactly what you're saying. You know, Halloween happens, but that's not the same movie as Assault on Precinct 13.
So it's in the Mouth 13. Of Madness.
That's my
favorite. You know, that movie is...
They're entirely different. Dark Star isn't the same movie as The Thing. You know, these aren't the same movies. They could loosely be called horror within the various genres. You know, Prince of Darkness, part of the Armageddon trilogy, that's a different movie again. But what he does, and I 100% agree, is that music gives it a sense of what can only be described as dread. Not fear, necessarily, dread.
That is my favorite emotion. Now you get it. You get it. My music has been entirely encapsulated with the idea of dread. Because fear is momentary. Fear is very heightened, sharp. I like the 666 Street Subway Station off of Shadow Empire, the Synthwave record, is my favorite. That's my favorite.
That might be your best record, by the way, Eric.
Thank you.
Your best record. There you go, ladies and gentlemen. If you're looking for a jumping off point, Shadow Empire is definitely where I would start. That's probably the thing that I was most impressed with in a collection of songs I was also very impressed with. But yeah, 100%.
That was a daring record for me because I was 90% known my entire life as a singer, and my instrumentation capabilities were always there to push my voice. And when I started this record, I was going to hide behind the vocal aspect. But my wife and I were listening into the car. We were driving all the way up to Ithaca, whatever. And we were listening, and I was like, I can't put vocals on this. That would ruin everything. The atmosphere is there. If I try to just shoehorn vocals on this, it's going to ruin it. It's going to make it a typical Eric Von product. And that would be more selling out than just trying to have the guts to put out, as a non-instrumentalist, to put out an all-instrumentalist record. It was terrifying. I mean, I remember the first week, it was like... Woof, man. Like, and a German reviewer said positive things, and that's when you know you're okay. Because they're always the first to say something, and if the Germans shit on it.
It's interesting that you talk about, you know, and I agree, that fear and almost shock are fleeting. That it's hard to keep fear up for a record or an EP, or it's hard to do that, you know. And when we talk about Carpenter, we talk about that dread is all the way through something like The Thing. It's all the way through for the 90 minutes or so, whatever it is, you feel that all the way through. There are moments of fear, the moments of shock, but that omnipresence dread is all the way through it. And now listening back to your work and you saying how much, you know, dread and that omnipresent shadow is always there, it makes sense. You know, it makes sense. And then that's a really hard thing to pull off. Anybody can do a jump scare. Someone jumps out from something. Anybody could do someone getting a head cut off, and that's crazy, and someone getting chased. You can do that for a few moments, but to maintain that, that's the real secret, isn't it? That real kind of, to really displace someone's feelings for the period of that record. You know, that's a real skill. And I think, you know, it's interesting that probably is the thing that ties a lot of your work together, be it synthwave, be it heavy, more extreme stuff, be it punk. There is all that omnipresence, almost danger, but definitely dread.
I would agree with that. I think it's partially my mentality. You know, since I've been born, it's been I kind of put my, because I grew up in a crash bang, it took me 4 decades to learn how not to crash the car anymore. You get comfortable crashing when all you know is car crashes. Anytime something's good, you crash the car because that's what you know. That's how you feel comfortable. And I lived a lot of that. And you were always dreading whatever a good thing, a great friendship could be ruined by your own disaster seeking, you know, because you can't trust anything. You don't feel comfortable in good things. So a lot of my work deals with the breaking points of everything. I've always been fascinated with every man's breaking point. And also, here's another thing that inspired me a lot. When I was 14 to 16, I worked in an old folks hospital. Like, we're talking, everybody in that hospital was on the way out. And you were often the last. I delivered food to these people. And you're often the last people these people ever fucking talk to. And it's that was the atmosphere of dread in that hospital was real. It was it was a place of death. People, everybody there was dying. Nobody was there. I remember the one guy I met there who was young. And I tried to bring him his food and he almost hit me. And he was like, I can get my own food. And I was like, well, okay, pal. Found out he had a brain tumor. So he was trying to claim ownership of anything, and being around that, it really keeps you alive to realize that, yes, your entire life is always threatened. Even if you have a lot of enemies, your life is threatened. If you're the most peaceful, loved man, the world is your enemy still. There is no safety in this existence. And it's a lot to cope with because most people go through their lives without thinking about the day their moment comes, the day they get the word from the doctor. And I've known so many people. New York was big on the drugs, and unfortunately a lot of my friends passed away, or we all fell out with each other because, you know, everybody was so jacked up, nobody could figure out where to begin with each other. And with my own upbringing, that compounded an already bad situation. You tend to gravitate to also kind of troubled people. And where metal, and also I think with punk, I thought I'd find more people like me. It was unsuccessful, of course, you know, because it's a delusion. But metal had a much more upper middle class audience, you know, like good, like a lot of them I thought would be like me, but they had good parents. They were fine. You know, they were in it for the thrills, and the music, you know. I'm not taking away their interest in the genre, but I couldn't find my people. And in punk, I found there was even more trust fund kids. You know, I was like, oh, this is terrible.
Yeah.
But if you saw the world and how people treated themselves, there's dread in everything. And I think if the more aware you are of the world and you're not living in a, you know, your middle class, oh, I'm going to walk to work every day and not pay attention. And I think people into metal have been opening their eyes. They're people who've seen a little more. Or they're fascinated in the realities versus the shell of, and as you said, it's a positive thing because when you do experience reality, it's a horrifying thing sometimes. It's a real shock to see, you know, like the unfortunate war in Ukraine, the stuff going on in Israel. These people are living horror shows.
Yeah.
And in America, it's very easy to have political conversations and say, I support this, I support that. But you're not the one in the ditch. You know, nobody in the ditch supports any of this.
It's one of the most interesting things about dread and darkness and the omnipresence of, you know, of mortality and stuff is if you can get hold of it and get sort of contained it, that can become hope. That can become okay. You know, I this guy did die at a place I worked at, but you know what? He lived a great life, and I'm going to try my fucking best today to get through today and live the best life I can. And, you know, my friend passed away from drug abuse or whatever it may be. Well, there's a lesson for me right there. Now I've got to fucking, you know, get nailed down and get this stuff done and get these things done. And, you know, people are like, oh, well, my time will come so and so. And you could see that as a ticking clock and go, okay, shit, that's the end. Or you can go, right, well, now that's my fucking starter's whistle to start getting my work out and get fucking serious and get on with some shit. You know, dread leads to hope. It does. It's, you know, it's because you when you realize that, you know, you've only got one chance around if you believe in that sort of thing.
Yeah.
You know, once you realize these things, you kind of go, okay, well, let's fucking go then. Let's get on with it. You know, you took, it seems to be, I wouldn't want to put words in your mouth, Eric, but it seems to be those stages were part of your life where you were kind of working with people, seeing the world, and you've took that now. And this part of your life now seems to be you going, okay, this is what I think of these things now, or this is how I think, you know, when someone goes away and writes the great American novel, that's what they're doing. They're taking all those life points and they're bringing out. And this sounds like this is an incredibly cathartic exercise for you as well.
Oh, it's beautiful. Yes, yes. No, you were completely correct. I mean, it's affected me in such a way that my sanity has improved tenfold, because through music, you can see all these things and sort them through a filter. And then the thing is, when, like, I went through a terrible breakup in 2019, like, it was life-shattering. I could not accept the end of it. You know, I was so heartbroken, and it caused me more problems. The heartbreak caused me more problems than anything in my life had ever done. You know, I was just, I was incapable of letting this situation go. And then even when I met my wife, it was still kind of in the back of my head bothering me. And when I recorded the record Awful, which I won't get into the story, you know, protect the names will remain anonymous. But when that record was done and I finally had it on a shelf, you know, I had a vinyl made of it just to have it. And I put it on the shelf, which it is being released on vinyl, everyone, through Barely Alive Records, full gatefold, all sorts of beautiful stuff. So go fucking buy the pre-order. That's my pro wrestling pitch right there, brother. But getting back to it, like having that record out, it didn't hurt anymore. I could let this person go because I finally told the story. And I think in life, a lot of people don't realize, and this is where metal has suffered the most. It is the best genre and the worst genre all at the same time. Punk hovers in being really cool, but it never has the cringe factor for the most part. That when the thing is, though, punk will never have the epic musicianship of metal. But when metal goes wrong, it is like, you don't want to be.
It goes really wrong. Yeah.
It goes so, like, late stage Manowar. Let's just go there. I love those guys. The early stuff with Ross the Boss is great, but do you remember that Greatest Hits cover where they're all in, like, the loincloths?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
I remember walking around a record store three times with it, and there was a hot chick at the counter, and I just couldn't do it. So,
I think it's because I don't want to speak for punky. I love my punk. Motorhead told us punk was okay.
Of course.
But I find that punk is quite quick to self-correct before it drops into parody. It's quite quick. Whereas metal is a little bit broader for correction. It kind of lets it go a little bit wilder than it needs to before it goes, oh, hold on a second. Let's have a look at that again. That's maybe not going to work for us. We've been, but punk seems to be a lot more self-correcting, which is interesting you know, punk has got probably one of the most broadest outlooks, because the rule is like, is it punk? Well, what is punk? You know, what are the defining characteristics? You know, it's like you get someone like, you know, there's a great documentary called Punker over four parts. And they talk about like kind of Green Day becoming massive. And someone saying, well, you're not punk anymore because you've sold 20 million records. And they were like, sorry, you know. And they're like, oh, yeah, but we are, aren't we? Like, well, no. Now everybody likes you, so you're not punk anymore. It's like the rules of punk are very, very ambiguous. So it's interesting that it does keep itself
punk is much more of a social rules. I think punk has far more social rules than musical.
Mm.
Where metal, on the other hand, has its rules are more musical. So people like there's a jock mentality to metal that didn't hit punk. Punk was very much about the art, the street level of it, the honesty. Yeah. And that's why people get called sellouts, because if you make a lot of money, you're appealing to too many people, then maybe you're not being as honest.
Mm.
But with metal, it became very, you had the jock element, like guys who will listen to anything with galloping guitars, the faster guitar, you know, the air guitar guy from the 80s who's like, this is fast, so it's good. But a lot of that stuff fell into such, like when it was parody, like Piledriver, it was great. When it wasn't parody, some of these bands, you're embarrassed to ever let anyone know you listen to some shit, because it gets the thing is, metal is, it relies on a lot of, like, one of my favorite musicians, of course, is King Diamond. I love King Diamond. Sure. I flew all the way to Vegas to see that Fate reunion, and that was the best show I had ever, like, Fate literally saved a terrible festival. Every, like, Paradise Lost got thrown off stage like a pub band. I mean, that's how bad the festival was. No, some guy gets up in Nick Holmes' face and is like, and Nick Holmes is like, well, I guess we're out of here. I was like, he was,
you know what?
I think
it may be is that I think that punk is always ugly.
Yeah.
And I'll try and preface that by saying I don't mean necessarily, you know, the people in it ugly, but it's always been the people who didn't fit in. It's always been people who didn't look right. It's always been the extreme thing from facial modification to hair styles like that. Whereas every so often, metal's been beautiful, or you know, it's been pretty. And those moments have sometimes been its downfall. When it's also been
very successful.
That's 100%. Is that, you know, once
my favorite punk bands cannot fill the venue that a smaller band like Mayhem can. If you look at the size of the business and the scope, other than maybe two or three punk bands that are truly punk, we're not talking Blink 182, but like even the Damned will play a smaller theater than Mayhem. And Mayhem, God bless them, they might, you know, they're one of those, like, when it comes to ticket sales wise, they're not like a Metallica. But they still, as what we would consider a more cult band, can fill a much bigger venue than a punk show. Punk shows still have that like internal crew mentality.
You could get bands like, you know, Black Flag and Bad Religion, and these bands, you know, should be arena level because that many people should listen to Bad Religion and they should listen to Bad Brains and the Black Flag. They should listen to these bands, but they. You know, they never did. They never filled that level. They kind of stayed that level. But they're still musically as important, maybe more so important than many bands out there. Their legacy is massive, you know. And so,
Well, they're actually better than some of these bands that can play like, I think the power metal thing was very difficult on me. Because some of it was good. Some of it was good. Like Hammerfall had a good record or two. But on a whole, it became metal's
The problem there happened when like kind of misogyny came into it and stuff, and it was like, that's not fucking cool, you know. It's like it became like power should be empowering, hence the name of the fucking genre. It shouldn't be about kind of like, you know, like fucking Conan the Barbarian treatment of women, you know. It shouldn't be that, like, you know, we don't want that. But it's interesting that, and I think maybe punk is really, really well good. It's good at self-correcting itself. It kind of, it never metal, gets too far. Metal, maybe a little lesser. Yeah.
Metal with the industry and the variety. Punk has variety, but there's a lot more overlap. Sometimes with metals, like breakaparts, death metal guys will often very much not go to a Stradivarius show, and a Stradivarius guy's not going to go to a Mayhem show. Mm. And that's one of the divides. Metal is such a vast landscape because of musical ability.
Yeah.
Punk has always relied on the beat. You know, the riff and the beat, that's where punk's power is. The riff, the beat, the chorus, and the vocal. Where metal can build entire soundscapes, like listen to Defenders of the Faith. Rock Hard, Ride Free is the most epic sounding end of the world science fiction.
100%.
Beautiful song. That opening riff is perfect. And 100%. You're not going to hear that at anywhere else but in metal.
Yeah.
But then you have that album cover. And nobody said to them, hey guys, that thing looks like a Chia pet, or what is it? One of those like a cardboard cutout pet. And I know it's a nitpick, but metal's sense of taste often is driven by people who don't get out as much, maybe. You know, you see some album covers and you're like, have you ever been to an art gallery? Do you? And that's where black metal became so happy for me. Here's the next story. If you talk about the youth phase, Spin magazine came out. And Spin magazine had the first American article about black metal. I got that it was in the waiting room of a eye doctor. I opened that and I read the things about dead and the bird, you know, smelling a dead bird before shows. And I was like, oh my fucking God, this is it. And then I snuck, my foster mother at that point was a hardcore Christian. So I had to sneak anything by her, you know, but I ordered from a distro, because you could get them in stores, Day Mysterious and Death Crush. And in 98, that blew my head off. That was, black metal was it. I was just like, this is the first time since Black Sabbath, that metal has felt truly off, dangerous, occult. You know, it was mysterious. And I'm not saying we should all be out there burning churches, killing each other, but that atmosphere was legitimate in that it really was just, for the first time in a long time, metal felt mysterious.
Almost dangerous, you know, almost like taboo and forbidden. Like, you know, like it's like you say, you know, to give it a movie equivalent, it's like the first time you watch something like Cannibal Holocaust. You know, you're not meant to watch that. It was, you know, you probably watched it on a pirate copy and whatever. It felt dangerous when I first heard Mayhem and bands like that, and even Bathory and stuff like that. It felt dangerous. It felt like, what the fuck? And like yourself, I read about it first before I heard it. So I heard about him burying his clothes for days and then digging them up and putting them on. And, you know, I read about these things and you know, it's only like some, you know, 20, 30 years later that we know the full story about what went on about things with Euronymous and stuff like that. But at the time, it felt like it felt dangerous and mysterious, that it was like something that I hadn't seen before, and then went to hear it. And it's produced terribly, let's be honest. It's produced terribly, but for what it is, that's the right production. It felt just like watching some kind of musical snuff film where I shouldn't be watching it or I shouldn't be hearing it. It felt like, I'll tell you what, it did feel like, it felt like it was damaging me, like it was affecting me.
But that's what I loved about it. Yes, I agree.
And that's what I loved about it.
Hey, Mysterious Dante Thetis, I heard that. I was like, this is the inverse of everything, you know, like, and I think in the late 90s, metal had hit its 80s peak of pretentiousness.
Yeah.
You know, what was it like, as much fun as it is, Stars was something that was turning off a whole generation of kids, you know, these rich millionaire guys walking around with their pompous sunglasses. And even when Iron Maiden started trying to be rock stars at the end, if you remember No Prayer for the Dying, and I like Fear of the Dark, but you can see them really trying to bend more towards commercialized hits in between the songs. Yeah. Like Wasting Love is absolutely atrocious. Heaven Can Wait, but there was another one. They had From Here to Eternity. Mm. They were trying so hard of Bring Your Daughter to the Slaughter. It's fun. But really, it really showed metal up as being out of new ideas, and how rich these guys were, that they could no longer compose relevant material. They had no ideas left another guy, Bruce Dickinson, his solo records, and you know the big thread between him and Halford and their good solo records, Roy G.
Yeah. Like Millionaire and stuff, and you know, and they were fantastic. So it's nice when an artist does that, who does go solo, and uses that to experiment, not just do a pastiche of the band that they're in, actually goes and does something interesting. You know what I mean? It's like, think about Two by Halford and stuff. This was dangerous stuff.
Like that record. I love it. Everybody shits on that record.
And it's interesting that you say, like, that, you know, they kind of, even both Priest and Maiden, you know, leaned into some of that stuff, you know, and leaned into being kind of like what was maybe potentially popular. What was good, and I think certainly in Priest's case and to a certain degree Maiden's, is that just at the point when you thought there was no coming back for that for Priest, they go and do Painkiller. And that's a fucking, you know, that's the complete, a complete return to form. Style.
Except for the lyrics,
And interestingly, that's the beginning point of, like, they go out with like Pantera and Annihilator then, and they jumpstart this next wave of kind of late 90s, sort of early 90s to late 90s, real aggressive kind of rock that's not eventually leads us to bands like Slipknot and et cetera, et cetera.
Pantera were highly important.
The bands that survive do that well, you know?
Pantera were so important that I think it's... I saw the reunion footage. I think it's a great idea. I know everybody has an opinion on it. You're not in the band. Let it go. If you don't like it, don't... My whole theory back in the day when I was younger, I was the loudest to shit on anything I disagreed with. Now that I'm 44 and I have so much work out that some people love and some people shit on, I'm just kind of like, if you don't like it, don't buy it. And I think with the Pantera reunion, if you don't want to see Zakk Wylde do it, you know, just don't go. Nobody's forcing you to go see Metallica or Pantera. Like, nobody has a gun to your head and says, yo, man, if you don't see Pantera tonight and have an opinion, you're going to die. You know what I mean? But there's that mentality.
It's like, you know, I mean, it's a difficult one. I had the privilege of speaking to Vinny, and I asked him that question before he passed. Like, I asked about reunions and stuff like that. And he was adamant, you know, that it should never happen. You know, that the band was the Abbots and that was it. And that's fine. And I understand that. Deeply respect it. And so I don't see it as Pantera. I don't see it as that. I don't see it's like, okay, you know, this is the new form of Pantera now. And that's it. It's not that. And, you know, if I'm a guitar player and, you know, seeing Zakk Wylde, if I thought for a second he was butchering Dimebag's playing, I'd roast the hell out of the guy. But he's not. He's playing and with a deep love. They've got Grady Champion, you know, Dimes old guitar tech with them.
He's
not doing it for the money. He's not doing it. You know, if he thought for 1 second the legacy was being shit on, he'd fucking, you know, he wouldn't do that.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Rita is part of the process as well. You know, these people are all inherent in the whole Abba family and the Pantera family. They wouldn't do that. And ultimately, you know, there's going to be a kid who never saw Pantera live. You know, he's 15 now or he's 16 now. He's never seen Pantera live. He's listened to Vulgar Display of Power, but he's never going to see that live. You know, for one night, he gets to hear Walk.
I think it's great. You know,
that's a cool thing. You know, that's a cool thing.
But it's also a lesson because in the 90s, as I said, for me, that was a very dark period where musically there was not a lot of new metal to put your teeth into. Like industrial was as close as we got, you know, where I lived because it was on TV. But Pantera were the heavy metal band for that mix, that generation that missed out on the late 90s, the 80s. But they also corrected something. I heard Painkiller as a kid and I heard Halford sing that like faster than a laser bullet. And I was like, a laser what? Like, no, man, I this isn't cool in the 90s. But then Phil came out, you know, with Warner of Walk. It was exciting. Yeah. And my favorite was The Great Southern Trendkill. That was the big one when I was listening. It's such a murky, horrifying record. And that's Dread. Once again, like that version of Phil Anselmo and that band, The Great Southern Trendkill is my favorite Pantera because it's just loaded with that southern murky bayou dread. And it's kind of a, once again, a damaging listen.
Yeah. I mean, that one, like, you know, Suicide Notes, both parts of it, they are, that's as dark and as heavy and as deep and as a trench you can walk down. You know, that's anti-radio friendly in every single sentiment. It is them doing exactly what they wanted to play, you know, completely devoid of anybody's influence. You know, that's just like, that is such a, it's even now it's got teeth on it. Even now that'll take a strip off you when you listen to that. Even now it maintains that thing that, like we talked about, that omnipresent dark shadow. And that's something that proves that there's a life to the music, proves that there's a soul to it, because you can't have that without feeling that at whatever levels you felt that. You can't produce that music. I mean, are we in a stage, Eric, where we're going to see these type of cycles and these type of resurgences again, or have we lost that because of the social media and the internet? Is that going to be possible again when we see it? Because I see black metal's had something of a resurgence because now an artist can get his music out very, very easily, much like yourself can almost circumnavigate a record label and kind of bring it out yourself. So in a metal band, so if you can be a one-man black metal project and put out whatever you fucking want.
You can be a one-man anything project. And I think one thing this has done is we grew up in an era where bands were everything, and the mythology of a band, every member contributing in honesty, having been in multiple bands, because some of the things that won't be released, like I was in a band called Agnosis. We did 2.5 records. I was with several others, and I have to work with them to get the rights to that for the 30th anniversary. And that's going to be a chore all on its own. But if you look at the band days, very few bands have that many contributing members. When it comes to songwriting, usually there's one guy leading the charge. And yeah, there was the days like Black Sabbath where you jammed in a room. But if you look at like the majority of bands, you have one guy who's the main thought process of everything. And songwriting has changed. And to go into the resurgence thing, black metal has had a resurgence because it's finally conquered its own demons. Like the Mayhem of now on stage delivers everything you could want from Mayhem. But as people, I would beg to say that they have grown up a lot, and you have a great atmosphere with a professional band. You know, they are a professional band now, not the mythological version of what you could think of Mayhem. They're a very bunch of professional guys doing a show. And I think a lot of these black metal guys have evolved, you know, even in the public eye. I don't know, you know, I don't want to speak for anyone personally, but I'm saying the business end of black metal has very much come into a self-awareness. These bands know how to make their money now. It's no longer just a bunch of kids in the woods doing something super cool and interesting. These bands have matured into actual, like, you know, machines that they can deliver. Like Mayhem, if you look at them in the OOs, the shows were very sparse. You know, you didn't get a lot of chances to see them. Now they're touring with Cannibal Corpse and tearing it up every night. That's a huge thing for that genre, is that it has become, it hasn't lost the music, but it has gained that amazing mainstream ability to entertain people and bring their message out without it being corrupted by their own mythology, because so many of the kids now are too young to even remember Lords of Chaos, the book. The movie, the movie didn't, I don't think, had the impact that like they hoped it would, because so many people were listening already.
Are you saying that, Eric, and it's probably a point I agree with if that's the case, is that the internet and that type of thing has removed some of the filters that sometimes would have got in the way of the music, and you get close to its original source?
100%, because now people can speak for themselves. People can make up their own minds. I mean, if I had had the internet back when I was a kid, I don't think I would have had the love affair as much, because so much would have been removed. Right. But for people to say that that will ruin the future is equally fucked up, because these kids now are learning on their own time in their own thing. And I think a lot of older guys, like, oh, they won't ever understand the joys of going to a record store. They won't care.
Yeah.
That's not part of it. We finally have a generation of metalheads that's not their reality. They never knew what that was, so it's not important to them. And if you're not willing to accept this evolution of music into the digital age, and kids now collect on Bandcamp. Bandcamp collection and your vinyl collection is what matters to these kids. Not as much of the scene, not as much of you. It's almost like there's an online scene, and individual bands get over now more than a genre of bands. I think that was a big thing. If you look at our histories, as we're a little more long in the tooth, you see bands, there always was a genre that would rise up and kind of, you know, wash over the scene. Like there's the black metal.
Yeah.
Death metal gave way to black metal gave way. Now you see individuals come up a lot more because there's so much space to learn. And I think outside of Stoner Doom, which was a big scene, there's still scenes, but on a whole, I think people are a little more open to listening to everything.
Yeah, I think it's a case of like back in '80s, the '90s, the late 2000s, you know, all these kind of sort of moments when these genres kind of explode. It takes several bands to push the door open. Like, you know, the grunge scene is 4 to 5 bands, door gets pushed open.
Yeah.
The metal scene is 4 to 5 bands, door gets pushed open. Now, I think we have the power that one band can do that. One band can push a door open and do that because it can catch traction a lot easier. It's more accessible a lot of the time, more easier. So one band can kind of do it. So instead of the rise of maybe genres, we're having the rise of individuals. You know, like you say, individual artists are more, it's easy for them to open that door now, singly, without being part of the genre. And then by extension, I suppose what you're saying is, and not be corrupted as well by that whole push. If you're traveling through that, you know, we think of the grunge scene, and we think of, you know, the headline acts of that, the Pearl Jams, the Soundgarden, and the Nirvanas, but right behind them is, you know, the Dwarves and Mudhoney, and maybe didn't get the recognition they did. Now, I think possibly, that maybe a single band can push through completely. That way you get stuff like bands like Sleep Token and Ghost, maybe. They're not, this is a genre to them, sure, but they're running forward on their own.
I have a good story about Ghost, because I worked at Webster Hall during the day, and it was the Ritz in the 80s that Guns N' Roses played, but I worked there during the day. That place was creepy as fuck. It was great. Worst job I ever had.
New York, isn't it?
Yeah, probably. They paid me in literally like a sandwich a night, but like whatever. I remember, because the one benefit was getting to see every show for free. And I remember seeing Ghost in the basement, this tiny venue. They couldn't even fit on the fucking stage, and they delivered. And I was like, oh, this is cool. They sound like Royster Club. 2 years later, they're in the big room upstairs. And I was like, this is awesome. It's great to see a band break like this. And I really think individual bands now, or individual artists, are going to be much stronger than scenes, where, you know, you have those 4 or 5. Because it also, one of metal's greatest misnomers is that it's we're the rebellious genre, we're the outsiders. Yet, if you really look at its history, you see lots of trends. And like, there is so many eras, if you read the books now, because now metal has a chance to look backwards at itself and go, wow, we've been doing this for almost, 40, 50 years? 60 maybe even. Mm. Now you can see that, yeah, metal itself has been as subject to trendiness. And even in underground metal, like if you remember when death metal became gore grind became, and one band would be like the standout, and then you'd have the four or five other scene bands that were big in that scene. And then, you know, 5 years later, they were all kind of relegated back to whatever new thing was being promoted. So, and I don't really worry about any of that. My whole thing is artists should not worry about the audience. They should worry about the art. And that's a dangerous, and that's something now I think you see more than ever, is that if you're worried about the audience, you're always going to be chasing your own tail. Oh, what if they don't like it? What if they don't, pal? If it sucks, if you write something dishonest that you think they're going to like, they're still going to hate it. Because they're going to smell the dishonesty on it and be like, well, that guy over there is doing something more interesting. Because now there isn't also, you don't have, and I always say I miss the magazines. I miss that kind of curation control. But that's because I'm not a 16-year-old kid on TikTok who's scrolling, who clicks a hashtag doom metal and listens to every band. That I realize that's how kids do it today. You click a hashtag on TikTok and they listen to every riff and then they stop on one. I actually sold like 8 records to a guy who found me on TikTok, and he just went, he's like, where do I buy this? And I sent them the link, boom, right there, made money. And I was like, this is how it works now. Touring is not even what it used to be.
No, not at all. It's, I think it's wonderful that you know, I think you're right. I think that, you know, when you look at you look back at the history of metal going, like you say, all the way back to the 60s and Blue Cheer and stuff and all that type of thing. When you go all the way back, you can see that we were susceptible to trends. Of course we were. We were. Of course we were.
Yeah.
And it's interesting that that's kind of, you've got that, and it's rooted in kind of the double helix running alongside it is technology. And I think those two things have been the reason we've kind of like, you know, you think about the boom of industrial music and digital sampling. Then you think about the evolution of 6 to 7 string guitars and things like that, and the availability of effects and things like that, how that plays a role. And I think that, yeah, we're susceptible to trends, both technologically based, but you're right, also fashion trends. It's impossible to think that all metal is created in a vacuum. It just isn't. It just isn't. You know, and it's nice that, you know, I think the best stuff, and I've said this a lot, the best times for metal or any genre is when it takes something that doesn't belong in it and takes a little bit of that magic dust and sprinkles it on its own stuff, and it creates something new and interesting. And, yes. Okay,
that's why I really try to do so much, because even if it doesn't work, and I have yet to release anything that I was like, wow, not that, you know, but I really like atmosphere. To me, atmosphere is everything. Atmospheric dustings. And you can transform any song by the atmosphere you put on it. And that's where, once again, it's funny because I never produced a record in my life till 3 years ago. Now I produce upwards. I produce records for other people, you know, and somehow I became, in 1 year, I became like a record producer. And that was like, and not just in knowing the technology, but having, but the taste you, and this is why AI, let's bring up something else. Everybody's terrified of AI. I'm not, because it's just another voice in a room. You have how many, and I love it when some guy I know, like there's kids out there whose band sound exactly like Pantera, and they're complaining that AI is ripping people off. And I'm like, the lack of self-awareness in this whole equation is right there. That's you literally, you're mad that the computer is stealing what you're trying to steal. So, pal.
Oh, yeah. What is a tribute band if it's not a physical form of AI?
Or and how many bands won't admit it but are tribute bands to a particular big band of the moment?
True.
And nobody wants to admit it. But AI has kind of shown that up. To me, AI is it's a tool. And the biggest, and Billy Corgan said it, and I actually agreed with him. And a lot of people are like, no, Billy Corgan. I'm like, it's about curation. It's about taste. You AI can write a million songs, but you have to be the one to listen and go, that's the one.
Yeah. Yeah. That kind of, you know, it's like when they first brought out, like in video games, and the eyes of a character in a video game were almost impossible to replicate. Even now, you can tell a character in a video game or an anime or whatever it is, that you can see there's nothing behind the eyes. There's no, there's nothing right there. It looks very realistic, photorealistic, but you can tell it's not really there. And it's the same thing with like AI-generated music. If you take a moment just to deeply listen to it, you can hear it's not quite there. It's not, and maybe it will be at some point, but right now, it's not. You're not going to create that, and that's the difference. I completely agree that it's, which makes for terrible podcasting, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. That me and Eric are just agreeing on a whole bunch of. I should disagree, but he said,
"Let's argue."
He's completely correct. Yeah, we should fight about it. But it's true, is that you know, it's a tool, and just to be used in the same way. You know, it's like this fear of technology that we seem to have is crippling some people's. You know, at first it was like. Well, it'd be a terrible thing if someone could produce a record in their basement, because that would be awful. But that's not true.
It would be awful for overpaid producers.
Yeah.
The only thing it was awful for was a business that wasn't giving back much anyway. And all the people who have the loudest complaints about this are not successful, because if you are able to successfully create, you don't worry about what's around you. You worry about what you're doing. And I realize in my least successful periods, that's when I was more interested in like looking at other bands and trying to, you know, bring attention to myself by starting shit when I was younger. And I was like, you know, if you were really that successful, you wouldn't be on the internet talking shit. You would be
getting it done,
writing songs. So at this point, I'm producing so much.
I don't read my own shit. I could program AI to write a song about the Chelsea Hotel. I could do that now. And there it is. And I could tweak it to that. But it wouldn't sound like your song about the Chelsea Hotel. It wouldn't sound, you know, it wouldn't sound like Roach at all. It would sound like a version of someone else's thing. It wouldn't have a starting point that yours did, you know what I mean? That's why I'm not worried about it.
I'm not worried about it. Like people fear change in this industry. Metal has had metal nostalgia is huge right now again, but I think people need to understand that music and everything changes. If you are unwilling to cope with this, you are truly left behind. If you're not willing to accept that, because everybody's like, oh, it's going to put a million people out of work. In metal, how many of these people actually have work? I'm going to be honest. Most of the people I know who are bitching about AI the most are like garage bands who think it's removing their future success. It's like, pal, if you were so good in your garage band or so dedicated, you wouldn't be paid. You wouldn't be worried about it because you'd be working.
Yeah. Well, the real way to see it is that, look, you can use AI to help you come up with a social media structure and schedule. You know, the non-sexy stuff, the stuff like that, that's great. In the same way, if I could say you could buy a lawnmower that will mow your lawn for free, it's probably taken some guy's job away that was mow your lawn, but that guy can go and do the fucking thing he wants to do. No one wants to mow the lawn. He wants to go and live his life. You know, he wants to go and kind of do something with himself. You're with AI, you're freeing up time to do the thing you fucking want to do. You know what I mean? It's like
I use a lot of it for the art. And I'll tell you, somebody told me, oh, that's wrong. You should pay real artists. And I'm like, why should I give an artist $300 for an album cover when I'm not even going to make that back? And I mean, I might make it back, but that's still a huge chunk out of what I'm going to make. And I love it how, you know, musicians have taken the biggest shafting in history. Napster, everybody sided against Metallica and kind of fucked them, man, because... Yeah, you did take money out of our pockets, you know, food off our table, and you didn't. You said it was cool to download music then because you were taking it away from Lars Ulrich, but instead they forget that King Diamond had to cancel a tour because of it, because they had insisted on Abigail Till selling a certain amount, and they traced the downloads. They actually leaked a download to see how much did. They said they lost about an income of 30,000 records, which for him was critical. So for these same people to now be crying about AI making pictures, it's like, well, you didn't give a shit about music when it was time to fight for that because you wanted to be cool outlaws. Yeah. Where is it now? Oh, wait, it's happening in film. Because as a film guy, I'm kind of amused at these strikes. These strikes have cost me a considerable amount of money, but at the same time, if you really look at it, these people are fighting something. A, they're not going to change, but B, what movies have they made recently of any value? Let's be honest. Let's be honest. What mainstream movie or sitcom could a machine not write because they've fallen asleep at the wheel? They're producing formula shit where they all get paid like $250,000 bottom to sit around a table and go, oh, let's have this girl say, ha ha ha, I'm pregnant, boom. No, You guys all fell asleep at the wheel. Technology took an advance on you and mimicked what you're doing, which is almost like it's like you're afraid. If a machine can mimic what you're doing something wrong. That's how I look at it. I'm not afraid of the machine. In fact, it's like Garry Kasparov. You want to fight the machine. Let's have a battle here.
You are talking the talk and walking the walk. You said not like 5 minutes ago that the guy found you via TikTok to a new form of social media. He finds your music. He gets in contact with you. He buys your record. You sell him that record, and that pays for a meal. It pays for a whatever. It pays for petrol. That is technology being harnessed and being used correctly, right? You haven't cried about the guy, you know, not being able to buy your music because you don't know how to work TikTok. You don't know how to work e-commerce. You haven't cried about it. You've just gone, okay, look, this is the thing. This is the new thing.
Crying doesn't help anyone.
Yeah, I'm here to embrace it, and it's tough because we're gonna with every iteration of anything from when they moved from using a tractor as opposed to a horse and it put a load of people out of work. Then there's going to be these paradigm shifts in culture, and I agree with you. I understand why the actors' guilds and stuff are complaining, because that is probably going to result in some people losing their jobs. That is probably going to happen. That may happen.
It happened with the steam engine
technology. Moving forward, irrespective, you know what I mean? It's the endless march of futuristic technology and the way forward. You can either, you know, get on board or be crushed under its foot, you know?
Well, and that's, I've always believed that, like, you're not dead till you're dead, but people want to stop in a comfort zone. They always want to be comfortable. And history has shown that you're never comfortable anywhere. You don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, as we've seen around the world. Like we went through, you know, everybody being locked in their house for 2 years. Now there's war. Now there's technology. Like but everybody I know is acting like, wow, things are so much worse than they've ever been. And I'm like, if you look at history, imagine how somebody in 1916 felt when World War I popped off.
Yeah.
To them, that was the paradigm shift. And music, I think metal has gotten very comfortable in it seemed, because it did stagnate yet again. Without the music necessarily, like you had Sleep Token, you had Ghost, you had new music cycling in and cycling out. But the scene and the way it did business had stagnated. And now they're really scared again, because you're seeing a whole paradigm shift and a culture shift where, and of course, metal is needed more than ever right now. Because we do have a world of catastrophes that need to be spoken of. And we don't need somebody, you know, prancing around on stage, you know, singing about war like, you know, like a joke, you know, like a fantasy story. You need people telling the real stories of the world. And metal has more material to pull from ever, you know.
I don't know if you can speak to this, because like to say you're a musician, an author, a director, is that, you know, this is one of the most exciting times in history to be a creative person, right? It's the most best time to get closest to in touch with your fans, the people who enjoy your music. It's easiest to produce. It's the easiest it's ever been to produce any form of media. It's the best time to be alive if you're a creative person, right?
Oh, people, like, sometimes excitement isn't good. I feel terrible for anybody in the world who's going through, you know, what they're going through. But for some guys, you know, they're going to be sitting around in the middle of nowhere with a metal record on in their ears, and that's going to get them through literally that night.
Yeah.
And people forget the power of music has never subsisted. Everybody's afraid music will die. Music has been around since man could bang two stones together. It's part of the human spirit. In fact, books are important because they preserve knowledge, but so do computers. But writing, but storytelling has always been an art. The only thing that has not been an art for long term, but people speak so much about, is film. And that will evolve differently, because all film is theater. And it may evolve to a new step, like holographic middle or live movie, 3D movies that you sit around. I see so many potential with that people are afraid of, because they want to keep Hollywood alive. Hollywood's a dead horse, man. It's not coming back. Like the 80s, once again, that comfort time in America, and I think even Europe, the 80s, when everything was kind of, you know, America was on top, the Soviet Union sucked. There's a night, and that's why synthwave to a degree is interesting, because it's a modernized fake version of the past. It really is kind of an idealized version, because I don't remember all that neon. I remember a lot of like fake wood paneling, you know? Sure. But and terrible looking station wagons. But yeah. When you listen to synthwave, it brings back that epic sci-fi feeling. But in a way, in the modern world, it makes sense again. It's almost the soundtrack to a new future.
Because we're doing it with movies, we're doing it with music, where we're kind of going back and almost trying to fix our past as well, what we thought it was
like. I think that's all art is like. Wow. All art is fixing the past. And I tried to explain this to someone. I'm like, if you're truly an artist, you're trying to work out whatever in your life was incomplete in a song. And you can complete it here. But you can't. It's the only part of the world where you can fix the past. And I kind of joke that this whole creative stretch, this madness move of recreating my entire career in 3 years was fixing the past.
Mm.
It fixed my past. I was at a point where I was like looking at myself in the mirror, like, you can tell everybody in the world you were a musician for 25 years, but what did you really leave behind? What do you have to show for this? So when I recorded that first song and it turned into another, it's not going to end until I do. I'm going to keep working because this is...
Is this 30 years then? Is this your legacy, sir?
I think so. I think well, the 30-year mark will be 2025, exactly. Mm-hmm. And this is what we all leave something behind in the world. My film work was mostly commercials. It's not that special. I helped write some books on New York City culture and small stuff, but I don't think that will be my big legacy. We do have a lyric book coming out with art that's going to be a beautiful big hardcover book of lyrics. We're going to do 3 editions, and it'll be from all the bands. It's going to be gorgeous. I'll send you a preview when we get off. I can't send it to you here, but so all of these projects though. But yeah, I think the music is like everybody has to think about what they're going to leave behind. And I think the music, my goal is to have 30 full length records by 2025, and that will be the story. And anything that comes out after will add, but I really want 30 records for 30 years.
Wow. That's quite something, sir. And I think you're well on your way to doing it. I think that's something great. I think the journey is exciting in and of itself, you know. And I think, you know, what would you have said to that kid that had that Misfits record at 15? What would you have said to him? His mind would have been blown, wouldn't it? If you said, you're going to have 30 years of work, you're going to support the Misfits. And what would you have said to him?
I would have just said, keep going. No matter how bad it gets, keep recording. But also I would have told him, focus on preserving ideas, not about showing yourself off. That would have been the one warning I would have given. Putting yourself in the public eye is going to be miserable for you because you don't like having people at you. And it's just going to be adversarial. Stay in the studio. Work. That would have been my advice. Stay in the studio. Work. That's where you're happy.
Ladies and gentlemen, we must have Eric on again. This has been a wonderful, absolutely wonderful set. I mean, I normally have a bit I take out of each episode that I use as a kind of a trailer for it. I am spoiled for choice with some of the stuff you've said. So thank you very much for coming on
the show. Of course, thank you for having me.
Deeply appreciate it. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Eric Vaughn, of course. Thank you for coming on the show, sir. Very, very
thank you, Mark. It was my pleasure. And I will come back soon. And we'll have about 18 more records to discuss next week. All right, man. I will see you later.
How good is that? How inspirational was Eric Von Arden? What do you think? Fuck, I'm just not doing enough. I need to fucking work hard. I need to stop doom scrolling and stop fucking sitting off and actually start getting on with some things, you know, and trying some things and not being afraid of failure, not being afraid of what other people think about, you know, people say you can't do something. And Eric Von just is this one man fucking wrecking machine, isn't he, of just getting stuff done. And you know, and as I was saying, I'll put links to all his work because there's so much, and it's such a high quality, fabulous musician and fabulous and wonderful human being. Very open about talking about the things that he was dealing with and, you know, the things he got wrong, you know, the things that maybe didn't work out for him. And that's incredibly powerful as well. You know, it's, you know, often when people try and do something different, do people think that there's an ego behind it? And I suppose there's a little bit of that that needs to happen. But generally speaking, it's about, you know, trying to do something good. And I think we'll definitely get Eric Vaughn on again. You know, it'd be wonderfully entertaining. We didn't even touch on horror as much as we'd like to do.
And it was seemed absolutely perfect to talk to him around the Halloween period. And I hope you enjoyed that. I hope you enjoy all the shows. I really do. I'm getting some wonderful back now when I go out to the live shows and people listen to shows and go, you know, I don't know who this person is that you're going to be talking to, but, you know, if you talk to them, I'm going to listen. And that's, I thank you very much for giving me your time. There's a lot of podcasts out there. There's a lot to listen to. And it's nice that we spend some time together doing that. And I hope you enjoy the style of the podcast. I'm told that people that way. It's more, you know, not what you, what's your favourite colour. It's more an open-ended conversation. That's been also some of the feedback I've been getting, which is wonderful to receive. That you're going to be able to see live on Thursday, the 9th of November. The Outpost, you're going to be able to hear this and see this show live, you know, and ask questions and see what goes on and be a part of this this whole thing, because you, the fans and the community, are the biggest thing about this. You tell me who I should talk to. You give me suggestions and I do them. We kind of adjust the show accordingly to make it something that you like to hear. You're the audience. You're the people that I want to involve in this. So doing a live show is absolutely the best thing in the world. It's a dream I've had for a while, and it's coming to fruition on the 9th of November. Of all places, the Outpost, the wonderful Outpost. So I'm really looking forward to that. And you'll hear a version of that show on this as a podcast, and I'll release it as a video as well. It's exciting times. And you know, we got off the call with Eric and I was just went straight to work again. I was like, I'm not doing enough, needs to be doing more. What more surprises, what more can we do, what more things can we promote? And the interesting thing is that a lot of this stuff is fucking free, like, you know, activity on TikTok and Instagram and these type of things are all free to do. You've just got to go and fucking do it, and it is hard and it's daunting and it takes time, and you almost sometimes feel as though you're shouting into the void, but it's incredibly important to do. Eric's looking at albums that 30 years ago that he's re-bringing back, that he's proud of and wants to be heard again. So you don't know what's the ultimate sort of place that this will land, but it's important to try, and it's important to kind of do the things that you excite me. I cannot wait to do this live show, and I love speaking to fans about the show itself. I hope you really enjoyed this episode with Eric Vaughan. Perfectly timed for Halloween. And just a wonderful character. We will get him on again. As I say all the time, that's because I enjoy talking to these people. Once again, thanks for listening. I'll see you at the show.